I'm really delighted to be here with Rebecca Partoon today for our Albany Pet Services podcast. Rebecca is a behaviourist. She's always loved animals and she started her first pet sitting business at the tender age of 8. She started it when she was at her parents' hotel. Since then, she's worked in various animal businesses and spent the last 6 years doing animal-based courses, with her last one being a master's at the prestigious University of Lincoln. The reason Rebecca decided to go into this industry is because of her current dog, her little staffy, Doug. Rebecca rescued Doug from a puppy farm, and since then, he has been fear aggressive with other dogs. She's always wanted to learn more about his behaviour to help him. And she finds animal behaviour really fascinating. Doug, you'll be pleased to hear, is now a lot better. She feels she still has a lot of progress to make, but the bond she's created with Doug is amazing. If Rebecca can help other dog and cat owners learn to understand their pets and create that bond, she'd be very happy. So welcome, Rebecca. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So your business, Rebecca Partoon, -animalbehaviorist.com, for those of you who want to have a look, what kind of things do you help with and what areas do you cover?
I pretty much help with any type of behavioural problem in both dogs and cats. I'm fascinated by all behaviour, so literally anything I can help with. And I currently cover Shropshire and surrounding areas, but I also do remote consultations as well, so essentially all of the UK.
Brilliant, okay. So you used to work in a wildlife sanctuary, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that was so much fun.
What kind of animals did you work with there?
We had thousands of hedgehogs. Wow. Pretty much every bird species you'll see outside, foxes, badgers. We would often get deer come in as well.
Oh wow.
Owls, lots of different birds of prey. They were really, really fun to work with. Especially the crows. When we get baby crows in, they form such a quick bond to humans. It's so sweet.
Really?
God, they're noisy.
Oh, yeah, they are. Yeah. Yeah, they did some research on crows.
Mm.
Yeah, they're really clever animals.
So intelligent.
I live in Hertfordshire, so there's lots of deers, and there's an area in near Ayot St Green in Welling. It's where George Bernard Shaw's house is. It's not far from there. And they've got this area that you can sit in. It's like a cubby house, if you like, but it's got glass windows so you can see out. And they put food out for badgers, foxes, deer, and they would come and eat. Yeah, it's really nice to watch.
Oh bless. And now's the perfect time as well, if they have any spare pumpkins.
Halloween. Exactly. Yeah, I've heard badgers like those.
Oh, definitely.
So it's Animal Welfare Week this week, and obviously one of the five freedoms of animal welfare is the chance to perform natural behaviours. But obviously, sometimes doggies' natural behaviours don't always match with our human world. And sometimes it can either put them in danger. But obviously, we need to make sure that they're getting those needs out, because it can pop up as behavioural problems somewhere else. So just like us, if a need's not being met, an unmet need, it'll pop up somewhere else as something unattractive, like frustration.
Yeah.
Or something else. So could you talk to us a little bit about how you feel we can avoid frustration in dogs where possible?
Yeah, definitely. So there's loads of different things that can help kind of let them perform their natural behaviors, even if they may not be brilliant behaviors, but in a safe way. Where they're kind of prevented from doing these behaviors, frustration is literally classed as a barrier to their natural autonomy, where their expectation is violated. So it's literally one of the biggest key drivers now for causing behavioral problems. Often, like, we'll see kind of things where it's chewing or excessive barking, where a door is closed and the dog's unable to access the owner, or when the dog really wants a toy or a treat or affection, they get overexcited. Sometimes they'll urinate, or they might play bite, or aggression is very common as well, where I mean, for my dog, Doug, for example, he's scared of interacting with other dogs when he is on the lead. The lead is the barrier preventing him from running away or choosing the best way to interact. So it's preventing his choice of behavior. And so he lunges and growls at the other dogs to try and act as like a last resort to stopping them get close. But there are so many tools that we can use for kind of teaching impulse control. So there's wobble balls, puzzle boards, and specifically like playing tug. The best way to play tug is let them really like kind of rag on the rope, get their teeth kind of like really into it, but then don't let them win. So you teach them that they can control themselves and let go of the toy when you want them to or when they want to. Then they get a treat, but also not every time, so they don't kind of build a new expectation. You could also kind of make them watch you and wait to get their like attention. That's great when you're kind of like out on a dog walk and they see something that's really interesting. They want to just bomb over to it, but that can be really scary for other dogs, for other owners. So it's like they need to ask for permission first, same as like going through doors in the house. Make sure you go first and try and get the dog to like watch you before just bombing through. Also kind of like playing with flirt poles. So it kind of uses that chase behavior that they would naturally have, but doing it in a safe way where they're not outside chasing actual animals.
Yeah, of course. Because, you know, especially around here, we've got a lot of farmers' fields with sheep. And obviously a dog legally, sadly, can get shot by a farmer if it's worrying sheep. So that's a huge problem. So yeah, blurt poles can be a really good tool, like you say, for building up that impulse control. And again, the waiting at doors, it's not about, you know, that we have to go first. It's that they are learning to wait politely, because obviously someone might be walking past that's, you know, has a walking stick and you don't want them rushing way ahead. What kind of
like redirecting their behavior from something that could be considered problematic to something that's considered good and polite.
Just some boundaries for them to keep them safe and others safe. What kind of things, you touched on it a bit, kind of the barking and lunging, what kind of things can you see when a dog's frustrated? So a lot of people come and say, you know, my dog's being naughty, or my dog's being disobedient. But we always talk about trying to label the behavior. What can we actually see in the moment? So what kind of things do you see in frustration?
So I mean, Panksepp kind of created this work originally. He classed frustration as rage, but under his original work, the kind of like behavioral tendencies we would see is kind of like an increased focused effort at achieving like a specific goal. So they're laser focused, their eyes are completely pinned on something. They're no longer kind of like trying to get at something, they are just fully focused on getting that thing. It's like repeated attempts of getting at the thing they want or trying to get away from the thing they really don't want.
And it's
kind of, if you look really small at kind of like the communicative signals of the dogs, it's like the head gets a bit wider, where the parting of the ears is, they really excessively vocalize. So either whining, barking, growling, anything like that. They'll start lip licking. There's like tail swishing, snarling, yawning as well is quite common. But that's more of like a redirected and displacement behavior.
Yeah,
those are kind of the main kind of signs that you'd see during frustration. But then those can always lead to people considering them as problem behaviors, where it's excessive vocalization is, my dog keeps barking at other dogs every time we go out. It's like, oh, okay. Is that because they have like an intense desire to go see this other dog, or they're scared? Yeah. It's then trying to work out why they're doing it.
Yeah, it's not always black and white.
Definitely, yeah.
So maybe something that could be considered as separation-related challenges could actually be frustration.
Yeah, definitely. The one thing we were taught at Lincoln was never label it as separation anxiety, because it may not be anxiety. It may be frustration or desire or anything other than like a fear-based thing. And there's 4 different categories of separation-related problems. I can't remember all of them now. I'm sure my lecturers will hate me, but there's definitely much, like very, very different styles of separation problems, which are linked more to frustration rather than actual anxieties.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think it can be quite dangerous when we're kind of labeling things, like labeling behavior, or well not labeling the behavior, but labeling the dog, like the dog's aggressive or the dog.
Definitely, or saying like the dog's dominant.
Yes.
Even though dominance nowadays isn't really, I don't know what you'd say, it's not really something that is used very much in terms of describing a dog.
Yeah, I think Suzanne,
but for lay people it's very common.
Yeah, Suzanne Clothier talked about it. If a man's in on a desert island by himself, is he still dominant? Because there's no one to be dominant to. So it's kind of internal character state, but it's a byproduct of a relationship.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of misinformation around dominance as well.
Yeah.
Like it originally started as like, oh, that's how pack wolves are, where it's really pack wolves, the two, well, dominant members of the pack are just the parents, and then the submissives are then all the children, which I think is fascinating.
Did you work with wolves at all?
No, I haven't. I've always wanted to. Several of my friends from uni have gone on to work with wolves, and I'm so jealous.
Maybe that can be next on your list if you have any time.
Oh, definitely.
So obviously Doug, bless him, how old is Doug now?
He is 5 years old next month.
Oh, happy birthday. Maybe he's a fellow Scorpio like me, maybe.
Yes. Here as well.
So obviously Doug was from a puppy farm. So what research we know about puppy farms is that they can obviously be really stressful environments. And
yes,
if the mum's stressed, the dam, she can transfer that stress even in the womb to her dogs. So what kind of behaviours were you seeing with Doug when you know?
So when we pretty much when we first went to go have a look, as soon as we saw him, he was covered in scabs and cuts all over his body. His tail was broken. And even with his own littermates, anytime he would see another dog, he would completely freak out. He would start backing away and like really high-pitched yowling almost. And no one did anything to try and help. The people who were there would just kind of let it happen. And in this particular place as well, it was quite bad. They had several hunting dogs that would kind of just run around the house, come back in and like terrorize the puppies.
Yeah.
So it was quite stressful for the puppies. And then the mom wasn't even present. Yeah. So we had no idea what happened to her.
Yeah, it's always a red flag, can't it?
Yeah, so even when they were puppies, they didn't have their mom to try and show them right and wrong. So even down to dogs biting as a puppy, he would just bite relentlessly because he'd never learned from his mom the biting inhibition.
Yeah,
he was pretty much from the get-go terrified of other dogs.
Bless him. And obviously, and we keep referring back to the five freedoms because it's animal welfare week. Freedom from fear is one of the five freedoms. And obviously, it can be really, you know, we talk about freedom from fear, but obviously it's not always that simple. We can't have, you know, freedom from everything that we're scared of all the time.
Yeah, there's always got to be kind of like a healthy amount of anxiety present.
Yeah, and we just, yeah, and in life we can't get away from everything that we're scared of. But I think from our work, like you said, if we can help understand pets, what they're doing, the reasons that they're doing it, and giving them the tools to help themselves feel less scared.
Definitely. I think like one of my favorite things to teach dogs is like settle on a mat or creating safe havens. Just because anytime they do have that fear, they know they have a safe space that they can go to where they can try and get away from it as much as possible. And creating that bond with your dog, when you are out on a walk together, you don't have that safe haven, you become their safe haven essentially. And if you don't have that bond with them, it can be so detrimental to their levels of fear.
And how do you think we can build that bond, having a really good knowledge of canine body language?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for me with Doug, whenever I'd take him out when he was younger, I would be constantly watching him, constantly getting his attention, watching all of his behaviours. So if his tail was up, if it was down, if it was kind of wagging more towards the left or to the right, if he was yawning, if he was lip licking, anything like that. And then I would know, okay, he is quite scared in these situations. I'll try and focus his attention back to me. And then we would just sit down somewhere in the middle of the walk and I would get him to focus on me, give him loads of treats, get him to watch me sit, lay down, paw, roll over, do as many of his tricks. So he's starting to focus elsewhere and understand that I'm the one who's kind of helping him through that. And that really, really helped with our bond. And now when we go on walks together, anytime he starts to get a little bit more fearful, he just looks straight at me and I get really excited. I'm really happy that he knows that I'm kind of there to help him.
Oh, you talked about the tail wagging. So before I started working with animals, I automatically thought, like a lot of people, I imagine, that tail wagging means happy dog, but it's all about the position of the tail, which you touched on.
Definitely.
Left right variability and the positioning of the wag. Is there any other things you can think of that dogs do that we might think they're happy but, or not necessarily happy, but things that they're doing that we might misconstrue? Because I know it's easy to do if we're not looking at the behavior in the context that is happening, or even know what signs to spot.
Yeah, I mean, there was quite a lot of research done where pictures of dogs in different valences were shown to children, and the children would have to say if they were happy or sad or scared or stuff like that. And they always put, like, when the dog's smiling, they're really happy. Whereas smiling is usually a sign that we would see when the dog's very scared. It's like an open mouth, so they're able to get more of an intake of oxygen, which can help them in the scenario of fight or flight, where they could have a higher breathing rate, so they can use either of those. I think as well, kind of like panting, that's always looked at as like, oh yeah, they're smiling, they're really excited, but that's again kind of either frustration or fear. Yeah, quite a lot of different things that I've picked up on that aren't quite what they seem to be. And then going back to kind of like the tail positions, I think it's if they wag their tails towards the right, they are happy and confident, but if it's towards the left, they are more frightened. And it's important to notice as well if the tail's sticking all the way up, because that's normally a more happy dog, or if it's just kind of up and completely stationary, that's more them assessing their situation. Or if it like kind of lower down, that's usually uncertainty and sometimes fear.
That's really interesting. I heard about that in the lecture about the left and right sides of the tail as well. It's I always find it tricky when you're working with dogs that are bred that don't have those kind of long tails. They've got the short and curly tails, or they've got the folds in their face, which can
I
make it
think
really
any
hard to make it.
French bulldogs especially, I find them so difficult to read. They've got the short face, so you can't read their eyes properly, their nose. They pant frequently anyway because they can't get enough oxygen into their bodies. Then they don't have a tail, so then you can't recognize what's going on there. I mean, that's it was a French bulldog who bit me. So even though I like to think I know quite a lot about behavior, there is always elements where you're not going to be able to read them. And yeah, it's just so important to try and do everything you can to read them before making any decisions. And if you can't read them, maybe back off a little bit.
Absolutely. Play it safe. If in doubt, leave out.
Yeah.
If you saw a dog reacting to a dog, and you kind of got over that stress threshold, or any dog that you're working with, what would you recommend people to do?
Yeah, so anytime you're kind of like out with a dog, the best kind of situation is the desensitization and counter conditioning type thing. So gradually you'll get closer to other dogs, your dog will react, but then get their attention back onto you. Make sure you are well equipped with plenty of treats and toys as well, but toys that you can use kind of in like a calm sense. So something that you're going to like really make them go crazy with, such as like a tug rope, probably isn't a great idea because that's just going to send their arousal straight through the roof. So if you're kind of out with the dog, I had it the other day when me and my partner went to the beach with Doug, and we were sat there and we're eating our lunch, and this other dog who was off the lead came over to us, and for the whole time I had Doug completely focused on me. He was watching me. I was getting him to sit down, give me paw. Anytime he would try and look over at this other dog, I would just redirect his attention over to me. I would drop treats on the floor for him to try and hunt out. And in the end, the dog came right over to us. And then that's when Doug kind of snapped back at this other dog. And instead, he just got up and walked away. I didn't say anything, I didn't shout at him. anything like that, because that's just going to cause his fear to mount anyway. It's best if you can just kind of get up and move away from those type of situations and then get their attention back on you again.
You touched on arousal there.
Yes.
And if the dog is overstimulated, the last thing you want to do is pick them up.
Yes. Get them out of the situation,
is it? Because that might lead to a bite or redirect.
Yes, you pick them up. Again, it's that barrier to their natural autonomy. They can't run away as they would want to. And that intense arousal, even though they probably don't mean it, they're going to bite anyway. It's the same situation I had with the French bulldog at the vets. He was incredibly scared, very fearful at the vets. He was put under sedation, and so he then had that barrier to his natural autonomy. He didn't have any other choice other than having to lash out and bite. Unfortunately, I got too close in that situation, but it's just what happens with dogs. It happens with everyone. It happens in humans as well. If a human is kind of cornered, the one thing they're going to do is lash out and scream at you.
If they can't, so important
to just try and remove them from that situation as best you can in a much safer way. Best thing to do is always have your dog on a lead, I would say, unless they have perfect recall, which I'm going to say 99% don't. Have them on a lead, a long line, preferably not an extendable lead, but either a long line or short lead, anything like that, just so you can get up and move away.
Yeah, because a flexi lead can be quite painful, kind of jolts.
Yeah.
Doesn't it? I imagine the same way if you slam on the brakes and you go forward.
It's going to cause some major whiplash.
Yeah.
And I think they can be quite dangerous in terms of holding them as well. If you think about a normal dog lead, you put your hand into the lead and then wrap it round.
Yeah.
Whereas the extendable leads, it's just kind of a handle. You don't have a strong grip of that. So if you've got anything above a lab who's going to be strong, it's very likely that they can just pull it straight out of your hand.
Well, thank you so much, Rebecca.
You're very welcome.
So everyone, if you want to check Rebecca's website out, it's rebeccapartoon-animalbehaviorist.com. And I'm sure everyone found that really helpful. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. I hope they enjoyed.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.